One of the great puzzles of the American Revolution, even today, 250 years down the track, is how Thomas Jefferson, author of the proposition that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, how that man who wrote those immortal words could have owned hundreds of slaves, including four he fathered. Jefferson, of blessed memory, third president of the United States, builder of Monticello, one of the most beautiful houses in the world, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, was deeply conflicted about race. His attempts to resolve that conflict in his lifetime is the subject of a new book, Jefferson's Wolf, a founding father's troubling answer to the problem of slavery, written by Krista Dix Heide, professor of history at the University of Virginia, and Nicholas Guyot, professor of North American history at Cambridge. And Nick Guyot joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me on, David.
Now, Nick, Jefferson was 33 or 34 when he drafted the Declaration of Independence. He was a young man. Would he at that time have seen any contradiction between his life and his rhetoric?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, the first thing I should say is that Jefferson grew up in late colonial Virginia, which was a place where slavery was utterly normalized. So it was kind of everywhere for a person like Jefferson. So his father had owned enslaved people. He himself inherited enslaved people when his father died. When he got married in 1773, his new wife owned enslaved people through her father. So slavery was everywhere. But at the same time, there was a movement that had been growing both in Europe and in the North American colonies to try to point out the contradiction, shall we say, between permanently holding people in slavery and Enlightenment ideas, so ideas about liberality and equality, and also religion, of course. So, you know, the golden rule, do unto others as you have them do unto you. So in a sense, in that moment in the 1770s, Jefferson's in this fix where slavery is everywhere in Virginia, but ideas, powerful ideas, both from religion and philosophy, seem to be suggesting that there may be a contradiction between slavery and the rights to which all human beings should be entitled. So that's kind of the backdrop to where he's at when he's writing the Declaration. But we should talk about the fact, I mean, all men are created equal. He did not mean that to include black people.
No. He was talking about his own people.
Yeah, I mean, again, I imagine many of your listeners will be able to relate to this. I mean, when one's thinking about why all men are created equal gets written down on that parchment paper in 1776, what Jefferson and the other founders of the United States are really arguing is that they, as white men, are equal to the white men in Britain with whom they've been in this political relationship for nearly two centuries. And in a sense, when Jefferson says all men are created equal, he's really saying the assembly in Virginia or the legislature in Massachusetts, they should be equal to Westminster. So actually, that's the kind of pitch of all men are created equal. He did not mean it to have a kind of universal understanding that would mean that black people or Native Americans or other peoples of color would be equal to white people. But the funny part is, I mean, even in 1776, a lot of people who heard him assume that's what he meant. So almost from the beginning, this more expansive understanding of all men are created equal, which of course really would threaten slavery, sort of slipped its bounds in Jefferson's pen and began to take on a life of its own. And in our book, we kind of tell the story of the next 50 years of Jefferson's life and how he grappled with a phrase that other people wanted to mean more than he did.
He was carried away by his own capacity for poetry.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think we really do need to go back 250 years and rediscover the momentousness and the radicalism of the American Revolution. So when you talk about poetry, in a sense, Jefferson needed the Declaration to be this sonorous thing, because what he was proposing, which is that a set of European colonies on the other side of the Atlantic could break away from their imperial parent and declare themselves equal with what he called the powers of the earth. That hadn't happened before.
No,
and that was a big deal.
An almost unprecedented event.
Yeah, and I mean, in a sense, if you think about the way that Europeans thought about politics and about civilization, as they'd have called it back then, they didn't think that that could exist beyond Europe in any way that would resemble European nations. So many people in Britain or in France would see the colonies in America as places of slavery, as places of race mixing, as places of oppression. And in a sense, even though they had those imperial ties, the fact that that oppression and that race mixing was happening on the other side of the Atlantic enabled them to preserve their idea of civilization as European. So what Jefferson's trying to sell in 1776 is the suggestion that North America could be the site of a nation a lot like Europe. And this also explains his problems with slavery, right? I mean, one of the reasons that Jefferson begins to realize that slavery has to go is it's not moral or religious. It's that he doesn't think that European nations will accept the United States as an equal if 20% of its population is enslaved.
It has to be a white nation.
Well, that's the other thing, right? So again, not wishing to kind of like launder Jefferson here too much, it's that second part, not just getting rid of slavery, but also getting rid of black people themselves, which is connected to this Jeffersonian project of trying to make the new United States seem like it's the same as these European nations, one of these powers of the earth I mentioned before. So the crazy part about Jefferson's career after 1776 is not that he is an enslaver or not that he is ostensibly against slavery, but that he set an incredible bar on the project of getting rid of enslaved people from the United States, which is you need to remove them physically. You don't just need to free them. In fact, if you free them, you then create the obligation to get them out of the United States. And this is a side of the story I think most people don't know about Jefferson, and this is something that we explore in the book.
Yes, but I learned from your book that there was an attempt to deal with some of this in earlier drafts of the Declaration of Independence, but it never made the final cut.
Yeah, so the Jefferson basically wrote a much longer version of the Declaration. And then, I mean, anyone out there in your listenership who's ever written anything that's met an editor will know that terrible feeling of the editor taking out the knife and kind of, you know, filleting what you've written. And that did happen to the Declaration. But actually, the Declaration's original draft didn't contain any provisions for ending slavery or even for curbing the slave trade. However, Jefferson did criticize the slave trade. So this is the trade mostly in British vessels that's bringing new enslaved people into the North American colonies. He criticized it and basically blamed George III for having allowed that slave trade to continue when he and other politicians in places like Virginia have been trying to restrict it. So on some level, there's a kind of soft signal there that the Americans have been trying to control slavery and that Westminster and the king have been stopping them from doing it. And in a way, that's the way I'd think about it. Not that the Declaration had a kind of unfulfilled anti-slavery promise, but it's really about control. He wanted Jefferson and the other founders to be able to control the question of slavery, whether they kept it or whether they lost it. And that is very much something that George III and Parliament hadn't been able to give them or willing to give them before 1776.
How much of Jefferson's thinking about slavery and his actions and failure to act on slavery was dictated by the fact that his slaves were his wealth and he was, for almost all of his life, deeply in debt. He was not free to free his slaves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. I might distinguish here a bit between his personal career as an enslaver and his political career, because you could argue that he's pretty disastrous at both. So he achieves almost nothing on the national political stage. And in fact, the institution of slavery gets much bigger across those last 50 years of his life after he writes the Declaration of Independence. I mean, he's going to live for another 50 years. He literally dies on July the 4th, 1826. It's a crazy coincidence. So there's exactly 50 years from when he writes the Declaration to his death. So in politics, he has very little success in curbing slavery. And in his private life, he does almost nothing to end slavery. And in fact, he frees barely a dozen people, most of whom are related to him through his relationship with Sally Hemings, both before he dies and then in his will. But I think the reasons for those two failures do look a bit different. I mean, we can get into them if you like, but the politics side of stuff, there's a whole set of obstacles because Jefferson has set this bar of getting rid of all black people. When it comes to the private stuff, so those people that he kept at his amazing house of Monticello, There, I think you're absolutely right that his personal means were so bound up in enslaved people. He didn't ever have the financial headroom, if you like, to be able to create the kind of demonstration effect of freeing black people, which might actually have made a really big difference to the national debate about ending slavery.
What is Jefferson's wolf?
Well, this is kind of a crazy image which Jefferson comes up with in 1820. And he's basically writing to a congressman from Maine, from the state of Maine, in the midst of this big crisis which is brewing over whether or not the federal government should allow slavery to expand into the territory of Missouri. And again, those of your listeners that know a little bit about 19th century American history will probably know that one of the reasons we get a civil war in 1861 is not just because slavery still exists, but because the North and the South have been fighting over whether new states coming into the United States as it expands westwards should be slave or free. So in 1820, there's a big debate surrounding one of those western states, Missouri. And this congressman writes to Jefferson, who is then nearly 80 years old, in retirement at his big house, Monticello in Virginia. And the congressman says, please help us out. Give us some advice. What should we do with this debate? Should we let slavery go further to the West or not? And Jefferson writes back and he says, slavery is this incredibly tragic dilemma for Americans. And he says, slavery, it's like we have the wolf by the ear, not the ears. We have the wolf by the ear. We can neither hold him safely nor let him go. And actually, that's a sort of, for us, really crucial phrase to think about, not only because it demonstrates that Jefferson is also thinking about security. So one of his other reasons for being anxious about keeping people in slavery is his fear they will rebel, which is a big, big, big driver for him. But also that weird second part. So I understand if you've got a wolf, you can't hold him safely and he's thrashing around. But when it comes to freeing black people from slavery, why would you imagine that they would then be really dangerous? Wouldn't you think that freeing them would alleviate or remove that danger that they would rise up against you? So actually, it's that idea of black freedom as threatening, which we really try and explore in the book.
Yes, yes. And you argue in the book that actually they'd be rather grateful to be freed. They might quite like you for freeing them. But how much do you think his fears were formed by watching at quite close range the massive slave uprising in San Domingo?
Yeah, I mean, what became the Haitian Revolution, which starts in 1791 and ends in 1804 with the Declaration of Independence in Haiti, which is in some ways modeled on the US Declaration of Independence, fascinatingly. That's the largest slave revolt in human history. It's incredibly bloody. The French make several efforts to try and put it down and get the colony back. We go into this in a book because it's so interesting that Jefferson is both kind of terrified and excited by the Haitian Revolution. So he's terrified by it because it seems to bring into focus all of these fears that eventually, if you leave enslaved people for long enough, the slumbering volcano will erupt and every white person will be consumed by it. But he's also excited by the Haitian Revolution, and this is the crazy part, because he begins to think if Haiti becomes independent under a black-led government, so the first black-led independent government anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, then maybe that government will agree to take enslaved people from the United States if they're freed by the federal government or by the states. So he actually brings up this idea of Haiti both as a kind of terror in the night, but also as a potential savior, as a kind of receptacle for 500,000 or more black people who are in slavery in the US that he wants to free on condition of getting rid of them.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Barr. I'm talking to Nick Guyatt about his book in which he addresses the deep contradictions in Jefferson's life over race. Nick, his argument was, we free them, but they have to go. And you make the point that that was a widely held view in the new country.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of bonkers. Again, depending on how much your listeners might know about this story, even Abraham Lincoln, the sainted Abraham Lincoln, gets elected in 1860 to the presidency with a policy platform that promises to colonize freed people when slavery ends in the South. So, you know, Lincoln's expecting in 1860 that slavery will hold on in the South, probably into the 20th century. But his plans for getting rid of it do not involve recognizing black people as citizens, but instead trying to find ways to send them to other places. And in fact, Lincoln in 1861 comes up with this crazy plan to try and buy a colony in Panama. Do you know the story, David? It's nuts. So,
no,
so
I
buying
don't.
A colony in, so Lincoln.
It sounds so modern, Nick.
I mean, so well, precisely. I mean, it does sound very Trumpian. So Lincoln basically gets money from Congress to buy a space in Panama with the proposal that black people will be freed, so who are enslaved still, 4 million slaves at that point, they'll be freed and they'll be sent to Panama in freedom, but to work in the coal mines. He also buys an island off the coast of Haiti, where he's in 1863, incredibly, where he's also planning to try and resettle black people. So although there is some evidence in the last year or so of Lincoln's life that he did begin to realize, mostly because of black military service in the Civil War, that black citizenship is something that the U.S. should be trying to at least accept the possibility of. His entire political career, he'd been someone plotting black removal in terms that are not that dissimilar to Thomas Jefferson. And I would say pretty much every politician, certainly every major politician who was not committed to permanent slavery, all of them who are committed to gradual emancipation, believe that what they call colonization, the removal of the freed people from the U.S. was the way to go. So actually, Jefferson's shadow here, the shadow of this idea, is a really long one. And just one final thing, Jefferson's buddy and kind of protege, James Madison, who is the guy that actually wrote the Federal Constitution or played a large part in writing in 1787, and who succeeded Jefferson to the White House in 1809, he actually died in 1836 as the president of something called the American Colonization Society, which is a private society intended to promote getting rid of black people from the US. So it's bizarre to me that we've sort of lost track of the fact that so much of this opposition to slavery in the early United States was premised on removing black people from the new republic.
And I take it those newly freed black people wouldn't have much say in their fate. I mean, they wouldn't be allowed to stay if they wanted to stay.
Well, I don't know if this is the kind of book where I should say spoiler alert, but I'm going to say spoiler alert, David, because actually part of the story that we're trying to tell is a shift in Jefferson's thinking from believing in the early years of his plotting about this in the 1770s and the 1780s that you would need the consent of enslaved people. You know, you'd need people to agree to go, to deciding in his final years when he's in his late 70s and his 80s that actually these people should be deported. So in fact, partly because he realizes that a lot of black people do not want to leave the land of their birth, even if they're promised their freedom for an uncertain future in Africa or the Caribbean, when he realizes that consent is not going to be forthcoming, he just takes away that criterion and says, look, well, let's not ask them, let's just get rid of them.
The other scheme for, you know, finding somewhere to send them, always the difficulty, isn't it? You know, where do they go? It sounds a bit like some of the arguments about Gaza these days.
Sure.
Is the creation of Liberia. Now, how did the United States get Liberia? How was it used? Did it work?
Let me think. Well, it certainly did. I mean, depending on what the problem it's intended to solve.
Yes.
I mean, Liberia. So Liberia is founded in 1820. And again, it's founded in effect through the largesse of one of Jefferson's neighbors and successors in the White House, a guy called James Monroe. So he becomes another one of these Virginia enslavers who succeeds James Madison in the White House in 1817. And Monroe and Madison, like Jefferson, are very into this idea of getting rid of black people. However, Jefferson is always a bit nervous about getting the federal government to do it, because Jefferson has always been a kind of states' rights guy, always been a bit nervous about the idea of a national government having this kind of power. And what could be a bigger power than running a colony or telling states that they need to end slavery? His successors, Madison and Monroe, were actually a lot more relaxed about that. So there's a bill passed in Congress in 1817. And it's, again, another mad story. So the reason that this bill is passed is that there are a lot of illegal slave ships, which are kind of, you know, cruising through the Atlantic during this period, and trafficking enslaved people from Africa or the Caribbean into the U.S. has been illegal since 1808. So Congress is really freaking out because it's like, okay, let's say we apprehend a big ship of 200 or 300 enslaved people. What do we do with those enslaved people? Do we free them and bring them into the United States? Or do we try and send them somewhere else? So Liberia is created by Congress in 1817, partly with the hopes it can be a receptacle for those illegally trafficked people. But then it very quickly also becomes a focus for American efforts to remove folks who were born in the United States in slavery and who might then be freed. But in terms of its success, it only manages to attract 10,000 colonists from 1820 until the eve of the Civil War in 1860. Across that period, the population of enslaved people in the US increases from 1.5 million to 4 million. So that's 2.5 million increase in the US and 10,000 people going to Liberia. So I think, setting aside the morals, David, that didn't work.
Didn't work, no. One of the ways that good-hearted slave owners showed that they were, in some senses, reasonably decent people was, when they died, to free large numbers of their slaves. But Jefferson did not do this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to throw the woke blanket at you here. I mean, good-hearted and slave. I mean, I know what you mean, but
I'm struggling for words here about this.
Well, let's take that at face value, and let's say you're absolutely right that one of the things that enslavers wanted to be was heroes of their own movies, right? Like, yes, that genuinely, yes, they thought of themselves very much in that context of being the kind of people that they would want others to judge positively based on their treatment of their slaves.
And gallant.
Actually, it is a bit of a, yeah, well, it's kind of a minefield now, because you very often get, I mean, especially like tele historians, so people that perhaps, you know, pop up on the TV telling stories about history, you will interview someone and say, was he a good slaveholder? And you mean the answer is, yes, no, there were no good slaveholders. However, I think you're absolutely right that one of the ways in which that liberality or largesse was performed by enslavers would be by trying to free enslaved people in their wills. But here again, it's fascinating. I mean, neither Jefferson nor Madison, that you would see as the two, I think, most important and most significant founding fathers, neither of them freed enslaved people in their wills. Washington did, but a large number of enslaved people belonged to his wife, so she retained those after he died. And for Jefferson, the reason he didn't do it, I think partly he knew that he would not be able to arrange the deportation or the removal of those enslaved people with their consent, but also because he was massively in debt. And yeah, I mean, you know, another story we tell in the book is that basically he owes about $100,000 when he dies. His enslaved people's value is somewhere in the $30,000, $35,000 region. So his creditors are like, we're going to need an auction. So in fact, there is one that takes place at the beginning of 1827 in January. And you have all of these enslaved people that have always, always refused to countenance the idea of leaving and going to another country, finally sold and scattered. So Jefferson gets the scattering of his enslaved people, but not in freedom to a new country, but in slavery to the Deep South or to the West. So it's a terrible story.
And then there is the long campaign to deny the fact that Jefferson had children with one of his slaves. And
yep.
And who was fighting that, and what was it about?
Well, I mean, okay, so I do think, so one thing you might say is, how on earth is it possible for Jefferson to be having sex with Sally Hemings, potentially for decades, and for him still to refuse to free enslaved people, both her and eventually the children they had together? And in the book, one of the things we talk about is that actually, even before he began having sex with Sally Hemings in Paris, in 1789, when he was the US ambassador to France, when she was only 15, I should say, and he's in his 40s. Even at that point, Jefferson, I think, had already said that it was terrible that so many white Virginian enslavers, especially young men, were having sex with enslaved people. And another reason to get rid of slavery was because of the licentiousness and the kind of indolence that it was encouraging.
Oh, dear
so
God.
Actually, well, yeah, so actually it's kind of, I mean, we talk about this a bit in the book, it's kind of nuts to think that in some ways, when Jefferson began forcing himself on Sally Hemings, he was able in his own mind to style himself as a victim, by which I mean the proximity of young enslaved women to men like him could be seen by him as the reason that he had lost his self-control. So it's kind of, again, to my kind of mind, both tragic and awful that the Sally Hemings kind of sexual encounters that he was having didn't persuade him for a moment that he might be wrong about getting rid of black people. Instead, it persuaded him that he'd been right all along. So yeah, I mean, the whole American history establishment for the longest time attempted to deny that this relationship with, I mean, we shouldn't call it a relationship, this sexual kind of, we should call it concubinage, that's the best word. She was his concubine. But that that dynamic between them, for the longest time, American historians had denied it. But from the very beginning, it was Sally Hemings' children with Jefferson who went public about it. So yes. Her son, Madison Hemings, in 1873, gave this interview to a newspaper guy saying, yeah, this is what happened. This is who Jefferson was. He's kind of a cold fish. He was my father. And the fascinating thing, David, is that African-Americans kept this story of Jefferson's black family alive across a century and a half in which most white historians, and of course the official historical establishment, was trying to deny it. And it was only in 2001 that the Jefferson Foundation, in his house Monticello, finally came out and accepted the DNA evidence that demonstrated that it was a settled fact that Jefferson had these black children with Sally Hemings. So that story was always known by black people, but it was very, very hard for white people to accept it.
An impossible question, Nick, to end. Do you nevertheless, in some way, admire this man?
Well, let me flip that around and say that I think in a way, so we've talked almost exclusively about Jefferson, what's going on in his head, what he did. What I really want to emphasize to close is that Jefferson is not the only person in this story. He is talking to so many other people in his historical moment who see this story differently than he does. He's talking to his enslaved people. You know, he's left us 60,000 letters or so in his correspondence. So there's a massive, massive volume of material there about just how often he was conversing with the people he enslaved. He talked with anti-slavery campaigners who are white and black. He talked to Virginians. He talked to French people, to Brits. All of those people provide us with a sense of the kind of moral headroom of his moment and actually also help us to assess the gulf between some of his higher ideas and his actions. And all I would say, David, is what's fascinating about this story, this moment in American history, is not Jefferson's genius or Jefferson's villainy, but the idea that this brilliant man had this idea about getting rid of black people, and in his own historical moment, he lost the argument. He lost it practically and intellectually. People wrote to him and said, this is a mad idea. Black people refused to go. Politicians wouldn't put the legislation on the books. So in some respects, I think capturing the true kind of meaning of the story is not just about focusing on Jefferson. It's about focusing on all those other people who, as I said at the beginning, could imagine a meaning for all men are created equal, which he never intended.
Yes, but he left those words. But those words are there.
And they inspired others. They inspired others in his moment, is my point. I mean, there's a Massachusetts preacher called Lemuel Haynes who, from the very, very first months after the Declaration, is invoking all men are created equal to say that slavery must end. There's the black mathematician Benjamin Banneker in the 1790s who writes to Jefferson and says, hey, you wrote all men are created equal. That must mean you oppose slavery. There are all these wonderful stories we try and tell of people, but who are inspired exactly as you suggested by what Jefferson wrote. And I think, I mean, maybe that's a good place to end. I mean, it's a reminder that sometimes the things people write can be bigger and better than they are.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David.
I've been talking to Professor Nicholas Guyatt, who, with Krista Dix-Heide, has written this book, Jefferson's Wolf, A Founding Father's Troubling Answer to the Problem of Slavery, just published by Harvard University Press.